This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. My guest is musician, songwriter, and singer Mac Rebenack, who's better known to many of his listeners as Dr. John. His best-known songs include Right Place, Wrong Time, and Such a Night.
Such a night. It's such a night. Somebody else will. If I don't do it, you know somebody else will. If I don't do it.
Mac Rebenack grew up in New Orleans and came of age when the city was one of the rock and roll capitals. In his teens, he worked as a session musician and producer with performers that epitomized the New Orleans sound, like Jimmy Clanton, Frankie Ford, and Huey Piano Smith. In the mid-60s, he left for Los Angeles, where he created the Dr. John persona. As Dr. John the Night Tripper, he led a production that combined voodoo psychedelia and old medicine shows. He would emerge on stage dressed in sparkling robes and shoot glitter out over the audience. A troupe of dancers performed to his band's music that fused New Orleans rhythms with acid rock. He continued to perform under the name Dr. John even as he phased out the show. In the early 80s, Rebenack moved to New York and made his record debut as a solo rhythm and blues pianist, paying tribute to his mentor, Professor Longhair. Mac Rebenack started performing as a teenager. He played the New Orleans clubs with older musicians who promised his parents they'd look out for him. He told me what the club scene was like.
Most of the clubs were fronts for something else. It was like you know, they were the B drinkers and all, working prostitution out the backs of the clubs. They all had these motels connected to them. There was gambling going on, like in all these hidden rooms around the clubs. And it was all pretty, like, what was great about it was it left the club owners hired bands that played music that they liked. And there was a lot of freedom, so bands in those days did not have to play for the public. They played for club owners that enjoyed music. And what happened, there was a lot of clubs that had bebop music or different forms of music that was great for musicians who weren't under pressure to pack people in a club. Because these guys didn't even care if there was any people necessarily in the club, because that's not where their money was necessarily coming.
Were there a lot of knife fights or gun fights at some of the rougher clubs that you played?
Oh, yeah. Some of the joints were real, you know, typical bucket of blood joints. And there was some of the places that my family knew I was working, and some of them would have just pulled me out the whole scene. I mean, there was nights that guys would push me behind, like these one-armed bandits, you know, those slot machines, and would use them like shields and shove me behind them when they'd see the guns come out and stuff. And, like, man, it was a night, you know, that somebody got shot, stabbed, or whatever.
If the guns or the knives were coming out, were you supposed to keep playing?
Yes, we always were instructed to play loud and fast when trouble happened. That was kind of the rule of thumb. When trouble starts, you play loud and fast.
What was that supposed to accomplish?
Drown out the trouble.
Oh. Did it work?
Yeah.
So people wouldn't notice that much what was happening?
Yeah, so the bouncer could clear the people out the place, and usually nobody was the wiser that somebody was murdered or whatever happened. It was usually not even noticed by the bulk of the paying people.
Was there a separate black and white music scene when you were coming of age?
Well, there were separate unions. There was segregated unions, which was a real problem for me because especially as I was working in the recording scene, I had flack from the white union for hiring black musicians. I had flack from the black musician about hiring white musicians. So both unions were giving me trouble for hiring the other guys when what I was doing was trying to hire the best guys to fill the jobs.
How did you start doing studio work?
Well, I hung at the studio, myself and James Booker and several of the musicians. As kids, we just literally hung at the studio hoping somebody would get sick or get hurt and that we'd get the sub for them. And, I mean, literally, we made, you know, novenas to the saints that somebody would get ill, that we'd get a chance to play. And we'd wait. And occasionally, somebody would be late and we'd get to play for a little bit. And usually, they'd come and we'd get shooed out again. But, slowly but surely, we kind of got accepted into the clique, and it was like, I think, more to do with persistence and than talent, you know.
What are some of the sessions that you played on that became big hits nationwide?
Well, early on, some of the Huey Smith and the Clowns things and Frankie Ford sessions and Jimmy Clanton sessions, like with Huey Smith. It's funny, I listened to some of the records that we had done, and I don't know what I played on them because Huey Smith would take me as a guitarist and say, play a conga part or play a bongo part. And I've played more things that, on records as a guitarist that don't sound like a guitar than I did that sound like a guitar.
I want to play a recording from your Gumbo album, and it's Those Lonely, Lonely Nights. What did you choose to do this song?
Well, I was looking for some Earl King songs. Earl was one of them. He and Huey Smith were the two of the guys that encouraged me to keep on writing songs. And they were like the up-and-coming guys. Like Huey Smith was the young piano player coming up at that time, and Earl King was like called Little Guitar Slim, who was like the hero of the guitars at the time.
And why don't we hear it? You're featured on piano and vocals.
Right.
On this recording of Those Lonely, Lonely Nights from Dr. John Mac Rebinac's album, Gumbo.
There's been some lonely, lonely nights. To me, you said that we would never part. Well, you know I love you, darling. Tell me, why did we have to part?
Those Lonely, Lonely Nights with my guest, Dr. John MacRebnak, featured on piano and vocals. When you started producing records, did you have a sound in mind that you were always going for?
When I first started, I didn't know what I was doing. I was such a a kid that got into things before I was ready. I was like the original learning on the job experience guy. All I knew was if I hired the best musicians, I got the best arranger, and got the right songs for the right singer, I had did my job correctly. Then all I had to do was get everybody to play it right in the studio, make sure we got a good tape, and my job was finished then. And it wasn't about so much getting a sound, to me it was getting a feeling. Once we had a track that felt good, that was it.
Did you ever have musicians from up north being sent down to the studio that you worked in to get the kind of rhythm backing and arrangements that you had been able to get on your records?
Well, a lot of acts would come down, say when the Chess Brothers would come from Chicago to New Orleans, they would bring a lot of their acts to record in New Orleans. But people like that would come in, and we'd do a lot of fun sessions. But what we didn't realize was a lot of these guys would take some stuff that we were doing and kind of analyzing it and trying to use this in other ways. And it got to be a real competitive scene where, that song Lonely, Lonely Nights, was a hit by Earl King. It was the second biggest R&B record of the year it came out, but on the West Coast and other parts of the United States, it was a hit by Johnny Guitar Watson out of L.A., whereas we didn't even know such a record existed till we got to the record convention, and lo and behold, there was a cover record that had outsold the original by a lot of records in these other areas.
Did you hear a lot of fake New Orleans-style music during that period of people who'd really figured out how to copy what you were doing but really weren't doing it with the kind of emotion that you felt that you and your musicians were?
More what happened was I saw more and more New Orleans musicians being absconded from New Orleans and being taken to California, to New York, and all over the country.
Once a lot of the studios wanted to hire away a lot of the New Orleans musicians, did you want to go? Did you leave at that point?
I didn't want to go because, in fact, the New Orleans scene was really falling apart fast in, 62, 63. The unions were freaked out about overdubbing. They would, came in and shut the studios down, and what all it did was there were new studios would open illegally around New Orleans, and we would get fined by the union for doing sessions. And it was I was in a lot of trouble with the union. I was in a lot of trouble at the time. And the whole scene, a lot of the companies were at that time going to Memphis to record and going to other cities. And what had happened was the union did not understand the competitiveness of the record business and was chasing away all our business. And the band all moved to California to work for Sam Cooke. Well, I was the holdout guy. I didn't want to leave New Orleans. I was working a good gig there playing organ. But these guys wanted me to go to California to play guitar. Well, I kept stalling and stalling. By the time I finally went, Sam Cooke was dead. And it was all, when I got there, it was expecting to go do some rhythm and blues music and stuff I was more used to, and I walked into the psychedelic era or a whole other thing, and it was really a culture shock at its worst.
Yeah, no, you went from this background of playing a music rooted in jazz and blues and early rock and roll. And then you became one of the leading figures in psychedelic music, and you'd created this persona for yourself, the Dr. John persona. How was that created? Was it your idea to do that?
Well, I had always came up with album concepts. I would think of this will be a project, and I would come up with a lot of album projects so that if I had some work to do that we'd have projects to fill in to do. And the Dr. John thing was, the idea was at the time there was no real shows that were out around. And the concept was to take all of the technology that I knew of show business from over the years, like throwing glitter to make the effect of magic, and using a lot of concepts that were easily and cheaply adaptable to show business and to make a show that would be real mystical in orientation for people. And it was a real, like, easy-to-do show. And all I had to do was to get a group of dancers, and I got all these people from New Orleans who were real familiar with that kind of music. And we did the album, and the show was geared to the snake dancers and all the regular voodoo shows of New Orleans. And unfortunately, when I first presented it, it was a little too authentic for the labels. They weren't quite ready for a guy biting a chicken's head off and stuff. So we modified the show down to a lot less authenticness, to more showbiz style, and took it on the road.
I want to play something from one of your early Dr. John the Night Tripper records, and this is from the Grigri album, and it's Grigri Gumbo Yaya. Do you want to say anything about when you started doing this song and how you'd get into it?
Well, this was the introduction song. Like, on the show, I would step on a button and have a big puff of smoke and say, they call me, and as the smoke cleared, it would look like I had just popped up. You know, it's an old magic trick. And that was like the introduction song to our show. And this also was like introducing myself to the audience as who and what Dr. John is.
They call me Dr. John, known as the Night Tripper. Got my satchel of gris in my hand. Then we tripping up and back down the bayou. I'm the last of the best, they call me the Gris-Gris man. Got many clients, come from miles around, running down my prescription. Got medicine to cure all y'all's ills. I got remedies of every description. No, I got to
green, green, gumbo, yeah, yeah.
Hey now.
Hey now, gumbo, yeah, yeah. Green, green, gumbo, yeah, yeah.
Hey now. You got love trouble, you got a bad woman you can't control, I got just the thing for you. Something called controlling hearts and get-together drops. If you work too hard and you need a little rest, try my Easy Life Rub or put some of my Boss Fix Jam in your breakfast. Try a little bit of...
Now, I think you hadn't sung or at least recorded your singing before recording in the persona of Dr. John. Was it hard to find your own voice when you were doing Dr. John?
I literally had no voice. I had never really sang other than a few risque songs after hours at clubs, but I'd never... The only thing I knew about singing was I knew how to sell songs as a songwriter. But I had no chops as a singer in any way, shape, or form, and I'm only recently kind of learning a little bit how to sing.
What was your reaction to the psychedelic music scene? You'd come from a very different background.
I was very turned off by it. like even though this became most of the venues that I'd work in later, the whole scene in general, it was like, it was more to me like the vibe of everybody being into the oneness of the planet. No, that was great, and the vibe, but it was like, it also, it's coming from Louisiana and being very paranoid and very leery of surface things, I felt like, hey, this is something that doesn't sit quite right, and it doesn't feel like there must be some real scurvy thing happening behind the scenes that I was expecting to flounce out at any moment. And then I was watching the after effects of this. I mean, I'd see these runaway kids that would hook up with our band, and like, I was around like the diggers who were like feeding all these runaway kids in the parks, and it was real other side to this coin of all the love and the love beads and all was in the marketplace, but there were kids that out there starving and freezing and not covered and didn't know how to take care of themselves. And it was very fortunate that there were guys like the Diggers and the Panthers feeding these kids and taking care of them.
Do you feel that the Dr. John and the Mac Rebennack parts of you are united now?
Yeah, I never ever felt any separation between the two things. I used to just believe that due to contractual problems that I had to keep things separate to the world at large.
You were born Roman Catholic. What got you so interested in voodoo?
Well, it's a real heavy part of New Orleans scene. When I was coming up, it was like, everybody I know, it's like you automatically, whether it was my grandmother or my grandfather, everybody did certain little gree-gree things. It was like the herbal remedies we took as a kid were strictly gree-gree things. And I don't think people, they look at the spells and the stuff, but that's a side of something, and it's a very small part of what gree-gree is about in Louisiana. And it's just part of the culture.
You were studying to be a priest in the Church of Voodoo and Witchcraft?
Well, what I actually did was legalize it. I chartered it so that the Reverend Mothers in New Orleans would not be busted for fortune-telling, for doing spells, and whatever they did prior to me having got a charter with the state of Louisiana. All these Reverend Mothers, who were some of the best people I ever knew, were getting busted on a regular basis for just going to hospitals and helping people, and it was ridiculous.
So you created the church to help legitimize their activities?
And it worked real well. It's like to this day they still can use this charter.
You know what I wanted to ask you about that I forgot to bring up earlier when you were talking about playing at the clubs? I had read somewhere that you were shot in the fingers, I think, during a club date. What happened? What's the story with that?
Well, I was playing a gig in Jacksonville, Florida, and Ronnie Barron, who was singing with our band at the time, he was, like, really underage. He was, like, a couple of years younger than me. And his mother had told me, look, you look out for Ronnie. And I remembered how guys had looked out for me when I was first out there. Well, I went to get Ronnie for a gig. I walk in the room, and this guy's pistol whipping him over, like, a jealous lover scene. And I went to try to get the gun out the guy's hand. And in doing it, I got my finger over the barrel instead of the handle of the gun. And as I hit the guy's hand on a rock to get the gun out of his hand, went off and blew the tip of my finger off. And I was fortunate they were able to sew the tip back on, but it's like affected me from being a guitar player. And it really took a toll. I really feel a lot of the contribution of me getting into drugs was out of connected with this incident, that I was very depressed about not being able to follow my career as a guitarist. And even though I went into playing keyboards and other things that worked out later, there was a long space of time when I was very Like, I had just geared my life to being a guitar player, and all of a sudden that was, like, gone, and it really messed my whole head up.
A couple of your latest albums really showcase your piano playing. Have you been seeing yourself as much of a pianist now as a singer or guitarist or producer or any of the other things that you've done?
Actually, I just have always looked at myself as just a musician. It plays in the rhythm section. I feel very awkward being called a piano player, a something, because what I do is, like, not necessarily, I'm not a great piano player, so to speak. I can play the piano, and I love to play the piano. I love to play music. But I just as much love to play the guitar, the bass, or the drums, or anything else in a rhythm section. And that's really my love. I feel very awkward making piano solo records because there's no interplay. And I always thought of doing something like that as like the end of the rope. From there, I'm stuck with playing the Holiday Inn circuit for the rest of my life, and I'll be in some little club, somebody drunkenly asking me to play Melancholy Baby or something, and that was my vision of this. Well, it didn't go that way, but that's a real underlying fear with this kind of thing to guys like me who've seen that happen to friends.
I want to play a piece in which you're featured at the piano. It's a composition that you wrote called Dorothy. My guest, Dr. John MacRebinack at the piano. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you for having me. I enjoyed this.
My guest has been MacRebinack, also known to his listeners as Dr. John. The piece we're listening to now, Dorothy, is featured on his album Dr. John Plays MacRebinack on the Clean Cuts record label. Fresh Air is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. The engineers for this edition were Orji Voblaitis and Joyce Lieberman. Fresh Air is edited by associate producer Amy Sallet, assistance from Marty Moss-Cohen, Danny Miller, and I produce the show. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening.
National distribution of Fresh Air is made possible in part with funds provided by Philadelphia-based Cigna Corporation, a provider of insurance and related financial services to businesses and individuals worldwide. Additional funding comes from NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.